You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a monthly program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective. And I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, we are going to be talking to Barbara Schuholm. Barbara is known for her nonfiction travel and memoir writing, for her mysteries, for her amazing travels into feminist literature and Norse sagas. I'm really delighted to have her today. She has also been a translator from Norwegian and Danish. She spent 3 winters in northern Scandinavia. I think this is kind of an appropriate show for November because it seems to be in the winter when those of us in Port Townsend start to think about the Baja. Barbara has often thought about going north into the dark and either dog mushing or looking for the northern lights or even being on the North Sea. So I am in awe of this woman. I'm happy to have her with us here today. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you, Chris.
I'm so happy that you're here once again. And I want to start from the very beginning. And there's a book that you wrote. It's called Incognito Street, How I Learned to Be a Writer from Travel. I'm kind of paraphrasing that. You didn't write it that long ago, maybe 10 years ago.
Right.
But it took place at the very beginning of your life as a wannabe writer. This book is really a gift, and it's really an inspiration to people that are pursuing something in them that wants to be creative and artistic, no matter what field it is. I think you don't sugarcoat it. What I think is particularly marvelous is that when you begin, you say, I am a writer, but you're far from that. You're far from that. And you were brave. So I want to talk a little bit about that story. You traveled for 3 years. You left a relationship that seemed to be slightly oppressive, but it took a lot of bravery to do that. And you didn't go to college at that point. Am I right about that? You said,
I was a dropout.
Yes. You said, what I really need to do, if I'm going to be a writer, is have some experiences. So off you went with your watercolors, your colored pencils, and your journals. It was kind of on a wing and a prayer. So tell us about some of the things that happened during those 3 years that really helped you see where you were going in your life.
Well, I was very fortunate in some ways. My grandmother had died a few years before, and she had left me a bit of money, $4,000, to go to college. And I immediately took that money and left college, University of Washington. And I went first to London, and I was there for a couple of weeks. And I went on to Paris and then Barcelona, where I stayed for a couple of months until a friend joined me. And at that point, I was barely 20, I think. And I didn't know a lot about these countries. Of course, I had been reading English literature for a long time. But London was, it was the middle of winter. It was dark. I immediately got cold. And then that was great because when I arrived in France, I had a wonderful thick nasal accent. And then in Barcelona, I really began to find myself. And when my friend Wendy came over, Laura, as she's called in the book, we then began hitchhiking. And I only had part of the money, I think, at that point. I don't think I was going to get all the rest of it until I was 21. And I think I was writing to the bank saying, please send me more.
Yes,
which was this whole drama in itself. Because after we went hitchhiking through Spain and Madrid, we then went to Italy. And I finally ended up in London with no way to get back.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's where the story turns a little dark, I must say.
It is a little bit dark. You know, I often was taking risks, not serious risks in some ways, but I would get to the edge of what I was able to do. And then fortunately, someone would usually appear or something good would happen. Mm-hmm. So nothing really bad ever happened to me. I did have to use my wits. I learned a lot of things about people. I learned a lot about theater and talking about books, reading lots, all the way through, I was reading.
And your refuge was the library and bookstores.
Yes.
In England, yeah. You had read Dickens, all of Dickens.
And absolutely.
And then you went back to that. One incident that I recall from the book is that you just happened to see a documentary about George Sand, and that turned something in your mind about women and who they could mm-hmm. be.
And well, I think in that era, 1970, there were not so many role models for the mm-hmm. kind of woman that I wanted to be. One of them was Simone de Beauvoir mm-hmm. because she was so free-spirited and a writer. And, of course, then I saw this film about George Sand with her cigars and her dressing in trousers and taking many lovers, including Chopin. And I think I found inspiration in her. You know, I don't think I had read any of her novels. I mean, we No. didn't read novels by women generally, except Louise May Alcott.
And it's more her life than her writing.
Yes.
That speaks to us.
Yes. Yes.
And so that's what awakened something in you.
Mm-hmm.
And then another time, I believe you were in Spain, and you had the opportunity to go hear a lecture by the Argentine writer Luis Borges.
Yeah.
But it wasn't so much about what he was talking about in his writing, but what he was reading, right?
Yeah. Well, I actually heard him in London, but I had encountered mm-hmm. him in Spain mm-hmm. through a book called Fictions, I think, Ficciones, and it made a huge impression on me. So when I was in London, I saw that he was reading, and I went there. He was quite elderly at that point. He was blind. So he did talk about his life. He had a lovely English accent, actually. He'd been quite influenced by British writers. So I think that I was always on the lookout for inspiration, mm-hmm. you know, the way you are when you're young. And I feel really fortunate that I was so dedicated to writing and dedicated to reading that I sort of soaked so much in at that point, because when I look back on it, it seems great luck.
And you had such a facility with languages, it seems to me. Everywhere you went, you were learning the language of the country and you spent enough time there. You got the idea of becoming a translator mm-hmm. at that point, which is something that you're pursuing now, correct?
Yes. I think that I thought for a while I could be a Spanish translator.
Mm-hmm.
And I did go back and went to the University of Granada for a year and learned to read Spanish and spoke Spanish all the time. But in the end, I didn't become a Spanish translator. I sort of turned to Norwegian. I had spent a lot of time in Scandinavia as well and worked there and worked as a dishwasher on the coastal steamer one summer. I was a manager of souvenir shop in the Norwegian mountains. And so I picked up Norwegian that way. And then later on, I began to read it and to translate. And I love translation. It's very congenial to me for some reason.
Mm-hmm. One thing that, as I've been reading your books, I've been very impressed with the fact that you do not just rely on what's happening to you in your travels, but you also do a great deal of research. And so you're reading the Norse sagas, you're reading primary writing of people that traveled in the same places you traveled 1,000 years ago, 100 years ago. And I found that very fascinating. I think that our listeners would enjoy that as mm-hmm. well. Let's talk a little bit about Virginia Woolf. Right near the end of that trip, you were in London again, and you were in the Victoria and Albert Museum, and you saw an exhibit about Virginia Woolf and realized that she also had started a small press.
That's right. She started the Hogarth Press. And I had been interested in the idea of making books for a long time, probably ever since I was about 8 years old and used to fold pieces of paper together and staple them and draw pictures. And I love this idea of creating books. And I think before I went to Europe, I had taken a bookbinding class. So I had learned to bookbind. And I always thought if I had the chance, I would love to have a letterpress and print. So once again, Virginia Woolf kind of provided the momentum and the inspiration on many different levels. I mean, I read her book, A Room of One's Own, at that point too, which was really mind-blowing at the time. I mean, you can read it today and still feel overwhelmed by her insight. But I think for me, it was sort of the first time I had ever so explicitly heard a woman writer say, you can do this and this is what you need to do.
And Barbara also talks about the realities of writing, that you can take your journal and write in your journal, but it doesn't turn into a fabulous book. And I remember when you're talking about A Room of One's Own, you got a room of your own and you weren't satisfied. It didn't work out to be the place that you wanted to write. So you continued to travel. And the thing is that you continued to pursue these ideas. So not immediately did you come back to Seattle and start your own press, but tell us a little bit about Seal Press and how you became a founder of.
Well, I think that if you're interested in something, your inner ears are always alert to things that will take you in that direction. So I did come back to Seattle and I had some part-time jobs, and then I went back to the U in one of my continuing attempts to sort of go back to school. But this time I started taking intensive Russian, which was a complete failure. I was kind of surrounded by Slavic majors. Mm-hmm. At any rate, I also started taking printing classes at Seattle Central, and I was learning to run an offset press. And I was also working in an alternative newspaper, the Northwest Passage, as a journalist at that point. And someone told me about a woman who had a letterpress. And she was starting to print broadsides, and there was a party, and they said she was going to be at this party, so I said, oh, I must meet her. Mm-hmm. And I kind of circled around her most of the evening, feeling very shy to go up to her. She seemed to be surrounded by people. At any rate, at one point she was leaving, so I rushed over to her, and I said, oh, you have a letterpress. I really want to learn to print. So the next day, I went over to her house. Her mother was Marjorie Nelson, an actor married to Victor Steinbrook, and they had the letterpress in their garage. Anyway, we started printing, and we started Seal Press that summer.
And you started with poetry.
We did start with poetry.
And then you figured that you needed to make some money and you needed to print some books too.
Yeah. Well, I think we were very interested in, there was a whole movement actually starting then called the Women in Print Movement. And we became part of that. Mm-hmm. And so we were doing women's studies. We did a lot of books on domestic violence. We did translations. We did fiction. It got larger and larger. And Rachel left to become first a mountain climber in Nepal and then a lawyer. But I continued with it for 18 years. And by that point, Seal was actually much larger. I think we had about 8 staff. Mm-hmm. And eventually, I remained an owner, but we sold it in 2001.
Well, it's a great success story. And you were writing also during these years.
I was writing.
And so you didn't start with the travel memoir. You started with your stories about a lesbian detective and the mysteries. And unfortunately, they're not in print any longer, but you can get them as ebooks, correct?
That's right. Yes, and you can get them on the secondhand market.
Oh, yes, of course.
I actually started with short stories, very poignant short stories about my childhood. But Seal Press needed money, and I thought, maybe I'll try a mystery. So my first one was called Murder in the Collective, and that became incredibly successful. So I went on, and it was good for Seal Press, and it was good for me.
You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM here in Port Townsend. This is Book Lovers Cafe. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. And today we are talking to author Barbara Schuholm. And I forgot to mention that Barbara is a resident of Port Townsend. She has lived many places and spent a lot of time in Scandinavia and in Lapland. I can't even say Scandinavia because it's north. It's north of it's the northern parts. And so in this part of the show, I'd like to talk about the Northlands and some of your writings there. And I was wondering if I could ask you to read a little bit from your book. Your book is called The Pirate Queen, In Search of Grace O'Malley and Other Legendary Women. And even though it's at the very end about legendary women, this book is just chock full of amazing stories about real women, about mythological women, about the sea. And it just shows you the breadth of Barbara's research and interests in a place that is difficult to live in, difficult to travel in, but very inspiring as a woman who lives right here at the very edge of the Olympic Peninsula. So, Barbara, can you read a little bit from this book? Thank you.
This is a section from a chapter called Enchantment, which is set in the Shetland Islands, and it's about people who live under the sea. Folk tales about the seal people seem to me to be more haunting than those of mermaids and fin folk, but all of them speak of loss and rebirth, transformation and love beyond death. More importantly, they offer a rich and imaginative way to cope with drowning so frequent in these rough seas. Throughout history, the sea has been divided in two, the surface and the deep. Very often, sailors and captains, mostly men and a few women, have seen the sea as road, as a watery thoroughfare between ports of arrival and departure. In these stories of sea as road, we hear of exploration, navigation, settlement, of battles and trade. But there's another, vaster marine world, and since the beginning of our collective memory of it, it has been populated by dangerous beasts and monsters, sea trows, fin folk, mermaids, and seal folk, as well as underwater goddesses like Sedna, the Inuit sea woman of the deep, or Ran of Norse legend. When praying to Aphrodite or the Virgin Mary doesn't work, when our ships founder and sink, we humans have needed to rely on some deeper wisdom, that the sea will return us to our origins, that the sea means, as mare does in old Egyptian, both waters and mother love. When I dream about my mother, when I allow myself to remember those dreams, I dream not so much that she is dead, but that she's across the water. She's on a ferry that is just departing. There's still time to step aboard. She is on a raft in the river, a raft that has just gone downstream ahead of me. Or I dream that she's swimming or flying, somehow moving around me, a liquid shifting presence, not close but near. She doesn't always look like herself, but I know her in my body, in every molecule. Sometimes she calls to me. She wants me to follow. But I don't follow. What would happen if I went toward her?
I think that's a wonderful example of how, as a writer, you take your subject, but then you blend in your own life and your own insights into the life of a woman and things that happen. In this book, I was particularly struck by not just the sagas and what is known, but what is unknown. And there's two stories about two women from Iceland. 1006, from Iceland. They lived in Iceland, but their families are known. So we've all heard, or most of us have heard, of Eric the Red and Leif the Lucky and their journeys from Iceland to be the first discoverers of North America, probably Newfoundland, Vinland. But not too many people know that Leif the Lucky had a sister, and her name was Freydis Eriksdotter. I guess the Icelandic people don't really like to talk about her very much because she was the Lizzie Borden of Iceland, or so the story goes. But you, Barbara, and reading the Norse saga and reading her stories from different sources, had a little bit of trouble with this story. Can you talk about that?
I was really interested in her from the get-go because I'm always interested in women who have a bad name in history. I think there must be something to that. And I was interested in the whole context of women who went from Iceland to Greenland, and then, of course, the women who went onwards to Vinland. And I wasn't the only one who was interested. There's a Canadian woman who's written a whole novel about Freydis. I was interested in why Freydis was the bad one when she was obviously wild and courageous and not that much different from her brother, Leif the Lucky. Why the story sort of adhered to her of being jealous and murderous and dishonest. There's a kind of level of hatred there in the description of her that is not necessarily there in sagas about the men. And so it interested me, too, that she had a sister-in-law, Gudrun Thorbjornor's daughter.
Thank you for saying her name.
Is kind of on the other end of the spectrum. She, too, was a voyager, and she went up the coast of Greenland, and she was also in Vinland. She was also one of the most widely traveled women of all time for that era. She went to Rome on a pilgrimage. So she first sailed to Norway and then walked through Europe to Rome and returned. So she's quite heroic. And there are lots of statues and things about her in Iceland. She's sort of the good sister. Mm-hmm. And Freydis is a bad sister. There are no statues of Freydis. And one of the things that I was so interested in on all my travels is the ways that women were remembered. In lots of countries, they had completely been written out of history. And my method of travel was just to walk around, look at the libraries, talk to people, and say, so what about women in the sea? And sometimes I would hear, oh, well, lassie, they never went to the fishing. And other times I would hear really interesting stories. And one of the things I liked about Iceland is that even though sometimes women had a bad rap, they were still remembered because Iceland is so big into genealogy and history, they have never really forgotten anyone. Mm-hmm. So they're a very uncomfortable relationship with someone like Freydis because they can't write her out of history, but at the same time, they're not going to celebrate what she managed to do, which was actually to get to the New World with her husband.
And then in that part of the book, you tie it in with a modern day woman, a sea voyager, Ellen, I think her name was.
Right.
And who was going on a trip in a long ship, and she was the only woman on board.
That's right.
And you know, today there are several memoirs about women in the sea alone. And so there's just something that's made women want to go out in these beautiful wooden boats and dare the elements and dare to say, we can do it too. Because when you were writing about, you know, women in the sea and all these guys in Norway and Iceland said, oh, you know, they're not strong enough to do this work. And then you found the women that because of they were widowed or their father didn't have any sons. Of course they did it. They were
right. Right. They needed to. I mean, there weren't so many people that you could just afford to ignore half the population. They were needed to fish. They were needed to bait the hooks. They were needed to take the sheep from island to island. So they had those skills. Mm-hmm. And you don't see statues of them and you don't hear songs about them, but they were certainly there.
Or I was particularly taken by the chapter on the herring lassies as well.
Yeah.
There's just something about saying the herring lassies. Not a romantic name, but not so romantic a lifestyle.
Right.
But
they had income, they had freedom, they had solidarity with each other, and they got to travel away from their family home in company with other girls following the herring fleets.
So after writing this book about women of the sea, then you went back again and you've written another book called The Palace of the Snow Queen, Winter Travels in Lapland. And you started to think about it as a way to explore tourism. And you decided to go in late November, early December. And this was an amazing trip. And of course, the tourism of the North is kind of an oxymoron. I don't know. People don't like to go there in the middle of winter. But you had some amazing experiences. A lot of people know about the Ice Hotel, but I like your perspective about it being there before it opened and it being almost like an artist collective. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful story. But also a very humorous and realistic story is your mushing fiasco, the New Year's dog mushing story. And you were taken in. You were taken in by that internet description of what it was going to be like.
I was. Well, I really wanted to cross the Finnmark Plateau. One of the things I did in my book was talk about earlier travelers. And the Sami, too, had crossed the Finnmark Plateau with their reindeer. But since there were really no reindeer tours on offer, I saw this dog sledding trip. And I persuaded a friend of mine, who's now my partner, to go with me. And lucky she did, because it was really quite a grueling experience. It was incredibly cold, for one thing. It was almost minus 40. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever spent...
Without enough snow.
Yeah. You know, there was not enough snow to cover the rocks.
Without enough food.
Without enough food. We had a lot of hot dogs.
Oh,
and we
it.
Had this quite Svengali-like leader, Sven, who was a former Iditarod champion, and his dogs, a man of few words, and his much, much younger girlfriend, Bodil, was mm-hmm. there too. Anyway, it was a very memorable trip. It was so cold. I've never been that cold in my life. I mean, mm-hmm. to be outside 8 hours a day in the dark and the snow on this sled, and of course you're always falling off the sled. The dogs are running wild. On the other hand, it's so beautiful. I've never seen anything as beautiful as being out on the plateau with the sun on one side, pale, pale sun, and then the moon rising on the other.
So from that trip, you learned about the Sami people. You learned about Amelia de Montfort, who also was a traveler and an artist. And so now you're writing historical fiction, which I love, and can't wait to read your books, Fossil Island and The Former World. Tell us something about those books so that people will be looking for them.
Well, I've been interested in Amelia de Montfort, who was a Danish ethnographer and artist for a long time. And she was born in Denmark. She went up to Lapland in 1904. And then she was so fascinated by the country that she went back in 1907 and 8. And she ended up writing a book about her experiences with the Lapps in the high mountains, which is an incredible travelogue. She was one of the only Europeans to actually make the migration from Norway to Sweden over the mountains in winter. So if you want to read something harrowing, crossing ice bridges and sort of rounding ravines with pack reindeer in 1908. Please read this book. But I translated it from Danish. There's lots to say about her, and I've been writing a biography of her as well. But another interesting aspect of her life is that when she was very young, 14, she found herself in a romantic relationship with the young Carl Nielsen, who was Denmark's greatest composer. He was 22 then, and she was 14. And this is a kind of an amazing story as well. She ended up writing a memoir about it when she was in her 70s. And it was this memoir that recently came to light that gave me the inspiration for my novels, because I wanted to explore that part of her life.
Well, congratulations for finding and discovering these amazing stories. Thank you for joining us here today. You You've been listening to Book Lovers Cafe, a program for everyone who hasn't read everything. That means you. And we are talking, and we have been talking to Barbara Schuholm. She's the author of Incognito Street and most recently, Former World and Fossil Island. Join me next time to spend more time talking about books and authors. Once again, I'm your host, Chris Wilson. I'd certainly like to thank Mike Schlexer, Larry Stein, and Nora Petrich, and everyone here at the station that make this wonderful radio station possible for us here in Port Townsend. So, read a good book. It's getting dark and cold, and we'll see you next time.